And welcome back to Speak Up Las Cruces. For the next half hour, we're going to be talking about the Stars. And more specifically, we're going to be talking about this month's Academy for Learning in Retirement presentation. The title is What's New in Astronomy? And I will let you know, first of all, I should welcome our guest, Dr. Chris Churchill, professor in the Astronomy Department at NMSU. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let me take just a minute and go down what the presentations are going to be this month. Starting on Tuesday, April 7th, it will be Dr. Jason Jakowitz. He is the head of the Astronomy Department at NMSU, and his presentation will be Peering Inside the Sun and Stars Using Starquakes. Before we go on, real quickly, what is a starquake? Do you know?
Like an earthquake, but on a star.
Kind of. I mean, basically, a star is sort of a gas ball, and they vibrate. You know, have you, for example, seen pictures of the astronauts in the space station, and they'll have a little ball of water, you know, and they can tap it, and then it will vibrate. Yeah, well, a star does the same thing in space. Not as dramatically, but...
Then Thursday, April 9th, that will be Dr. Eric Nielsen, and his presentation will be on taking pictures of extrapolar planets. I assume that's the new, what is the new?
The James Webb Space Telescope. Yeah, he does work with data from James Webb. Everybody's all over that telescope.
Yes.
But Eric is working with a special imager called GPI, which is designed to image planetary systems.
Okay. And then your presentation will be on Tuesday, April 14th. Quasars meet the tantalizing story of tellers of our cosmic history, and we'll get into that in just a minute.
Sounds good.
And then the last one will be on Thursday, and that will be Dr. Nancy Schanover, and her presentation will be The Changing Landscape of Solar System Exploration. All of those are going to be on the Doniana Community College campus, and more information is available about that, about those by going on the DACC website. And so with all that out there, welcome to Speak Up Las Cruces. Yes.
Thank you very much.
So let me start by asking you just sort of a basic question, and that is, how long have you been studying the field of astronomy? And then the next part of that is, how much has it changed because of developing technology over that period of time?
That is a great question. I mean, the second part of that question. Yeah. So I got my PhD in 1997. So I started honestly working in the field around 1990 when I got into grad school and things like that. And that was before the Hubble Space Telescope.
Right.
How much have things changed? It is unbelievable. The story that we know about the history of the universe has changed incredibly. For example, when I was just in graduate school, you know, we measure how far back in time we can see and study things using something called redshift. And the higher the redshift is, the further back in time you're looking. And with the James Webb Space Telescope, we're getting really out there now. We're getting back up to, say, redshifts of, say, 20. Now, what does that mean? That means you're getting back to when the universe was only several hundreds of millions of years old.
Mm.
Okay, way back in time. When I started graduate school, we thought galaxies formed we did no information, somewhere around, say, 5 to 10 billion years ago, that they were really in their major formation areas. And that would translate to a redshift of around 2, about 10 billion years ago. That'd be about when the universe was about 3 billion years old. Yeah, so about 10 billion years ago. But by the time I graduated, we had pushed everything out to redshift 3, which is another billion years back in time.
Uh-huh.
And so all of a sudden, that was crazy. And then by the time that I got my faculty position in 2003, we were out to redshifts 5 and 6. Uh-huh. And now we're out to redshifts, like I say, we're pushing redshifts 10 to 20, which is to say we're really probing very deeply into space now. Now, it's part of my talk to talk about how that's changed with time, because it's a storytelling situation.
Yes. Yeah.
So you sort of fit right into the ballpark of my talk right off the bat. But we had a very basic view of the cosmos, I would say. We knew that it had been hot and more dense in the past because we had measured something called the cosmic microwave background radiation, which said it was hot and dense in the past. But we really didn't know how it formed or how the structure looked. When we didn't even have a map of how galaxies were distributed across the universe. Hmm. And now with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey and a new one called the Dark Energy Sky Instrument, DESI, that map is really fleshing out. So it's like going from, you know, before the age of discovery, the maps of the world that were very vague and whatnot.
There be dragons.
Yeah, and now we've got, there be dragons. Yeah. And now we're down, you know, like Google Earth, you know, kind of things. It's just astonishing.
Yeah, an incredibly short period of time.
Yeah,
You look over the whole, you know, time of man on Earth.
I know, it's just a blink of the eye, you know.
Yeah.
The other thing is that the cosmic evolution story has changed so much and dramatically. First of all, this was before the year 2000, also, you know, when I started, when dark energy was discovered, and that was a Nobel Prize, and that was that the universe is not just expanding and kind of slowing down as it expands, but actually was accelerating and picking up speed as it expands. And that blew minds wide open about the universe. Now, there's so many places to start on talking about this, but in terms of the story of the universe now, we sort of have that hot, dense beginning, and then as it cooled, it became dark. Now what we know are called the Dark Ages, and we think that maybe the first black holes formed and the first stars started to form, and when the first stars formed, that means you have your first light being emitted, and so we call that sort of the cosmic dawn is what we call that. So we have the Dark Ages, and then we have cosmic dawn.
Who knew astronomers were poetic?
Yeah, well, you know, we have to come up with catchy names for this. So after cosmic dawn and galaxies started to form, and then you have all that light starts heating up all the gases between the stars, and you get this thing. It's a fancy word called reionization. It's just basically saying the universe is getting ionized again. And I won't go into all the physics of what that means, but that period lasted till about maybe redshift 5 or so. And then the galaxies and the quasars start really forming in earnest. And we have then a period that we call the cosmic noon. That follows that. And the cosmic noon is this period where the universe is just going gangbusters. You know, galaxies are forming, stars are forming. Everything is at its peak. The universe is really busy. And then around redshift 2, it starts to slow down. And that redshift 2 is when the universe is about 3 billion years old. So it's about 10 billion years ago. So most of this stuff happened a long time ago. And now we're in this period of just what we call this cosmic afternoon. Everything's getting more quiescent and things like that. And somewhere, someone threw some dice in there and said, oh, whatever this dark energy is, by the way, that became very strong in this cosmic afternoon period. So it didn't show up as the acceleration didn't show up until we were well into the cosmic afternoon. I couldn't told you any of this 20 years ago.
Yeah,
25 years ago.
That's a challenge for a professor. Every year you have to redo your notes.
you can't stop.
You
know, but you know,
the new questions.
But the beautiful thing about academia is you're surrounded by people.
Yes.
Young people, older people, senior people, early career people, and they all have different interests, and we all talk about what we're interested in. So that's happening. And then, of course, you know, did you hear about this paper? No, I didn't. And, you know, and then
the collaboration is really critical.
Yeah. So because you're within the culture, you kept getting fed the information and where to go look and and stuff like that. So,
in anticipation of you know the interview today, I looked up what quasars were because I didn't know, and once I read the definition, I still really didn't know. It's an appliance brand, is what it is to me. So, why don't we just start with that basic? What is a quasar, and what is your presentation going to talk about them?
So, my presentation is going to talk about how quasars have been used as a tool to understand a lot of what I just told you about the history of the universe and how we learned that. That's why I call them the storytellers. But what a quasar is itself is, you know, is effectively a supermassive black hole that you will find in the center of a galaxy. Hmm. And we think that basically every galaxy in its center, which we call the nuclear region, has a black hole. Hmm. Some of them are busy voraciously consuming material, and some of them are quiescent, turned on or turned off. Those that are turned on we call quasars, or sometimes we have another fancy name, AGN, for active galaxy nucleus. So AGN quasars. And so this is a huge black hole, probably about the mass of 9 million times the mass of the sun. It's very massive, and probably something about the size of the solar system. That's how compact that mass is. And if you have gas and material in the center of the galaxy, it will attract it gravitationally. Mm-hmm. And as the gas falls in, it will start to rotate around the black hole, and it will flatten out into a disk, kind of like a record. We call it a disk. And as it spins in, it gets hotter and hotter and hotter. And believe it or not, it's so hot it's emitting ultraviolet light, X-ray light, gamma rays, and everything like that. And even though it's being emitted near the black hole, it still can escape the region because it's heading outward from the disk. It's not within the what we call event horizon at the black hole yet. And so this tremendous amount of energy emitted in light from this disk as it heats up and falls into the black hole can be the power of, say, 4 trillion suns.
And that's what you can track.
And that's what we see. They're like a flash. They're like an otherworldly flashlight on the other side of the universe, or what we would call, you know, a lighthouse. And so how do we use them? First of all, they've helped us understand how galaxies evolve, because obviously if you've got something like that in the center of your galaxy, it's going to change how it grows and evolves. But think of a flashlight on the other side of the universe, and that light beam has been traveling across cosmic space and cosmic time before we happen to point a telescope at it and collect it. And it's been traveling for, say, 10, 12 billion years across the universe. So I like to think about it like a core sample of the universe in the same way that you think of geology. You know, you see a geologist will stick a core sample down into the earth, and they'll pull it back up, and they'll say, the deeper down I was, the further back in time I'm looking, and they can then chart cosmic or chart Earth time, if you will, geological time along that core sample. The same thing with the light sample across the universe. We can track what happened to the light beam 10 billion years ago, 9 billion years ago, 8 billion, all the way back to Earth in one light beam. And so now we can actually chart cosmic evolution of a lot of different things.
That's so exciting.
By the quasars.
Yeah, just by analyzing the light. We spread it out into its rainbow and its spectrum, and then you get something that to the untrained eye, this looks like a lot of squiggly lines. Really, if you plot it, it's like, what is that? But it is an amazing code. It's a cosmic code. And once you learn how to decipher it, the universe just lights up in front of you. You can measure everything about what's going on. And it's spectacular.
When I looked at your website at NMSU, you're now exploring using artificial intelligence and machine learning to see how those can be tools. Is that what I understand correctly for applications in your research on galaxy evolution?
Right, and it's not unique for our research group to be doing this. I mean, okay. artificial intelligence and machine learning is becoming a huge part of astronomy. For us, what we're trying to do is say, hey, you know, there are so many pieces of information in those quasar spectra, and no yeah. human can really go through them. What can take, in terms of human hours, say 3,000 hours, which you can imagine is multi-years of multi-people, just to try to yes. seed through this information, you can teach a machine to do it in seconds. Now, teaching the machine's the tricky part.
Right.
It sounds so easy.
Right. But right. it is amazing. Yeah. You know, and machines right now in astronomy are really good at classification. Mm-hmm. Like, is this a spectrum of a star or a quasar? Or is this, you know, feature from this kind of thing or that kind of thing? What's more difficult is to try to pull out the physics of what you're seeing. And that's where we're trying to push the envelope, but I can tell you we've been working on it for about 4 or 5 years now, and it's hard. It's really hard.
Yes.
So the downside of all of this new technology is that Pluto is no longer a planet.
Yeah.
Yeah, we got too smart. And
yeah, I can say we're all still a little bit upset about that.
I wonder if that will ever be reversed, but...
Well, it is what it is, I think.
Yeah.
You know, if our original information was wrong and new information is right, you know. Am I right that we're about ready to go launch another mission to the moon? Is that correct?
I am so glad you brought that up. I wanted to have an opportunity for your listeners to hear something about that.
Yeah, please.
So I grew up when Apollo, you know, I watched mm-hmm. Neil Armstrong at the age of 7. Changed my life. I became what modern people call an orphan of Apollo, which is to say, grew up thinking we would be going to the moon and living the world of the movie 2001, but yeah. didn't happen.
A lot of kids back then had that same yes. vision. Yeah.
Yep. Yes. Yeah. And so there's in a sense, an unspoken club
yes.
of these people.
Yes.
It's deeply passionate for many people.
Yeah.
But here we are today at 4:30 p.m. our time
yeah.
is the scheduled launch for Artemis II. Now, the last time we walked or went to the moon was December of 1972, the mm-hmm. Apollo 17, and Gene Cernan and Harrison Schmitt, one of the New Mexico's assemblymen,
that's right,
walked on the moon. And so that's the last time that humans have been to the moon. The first time we went to the moon was Apollo 8, and that was in December of 1968. Mm-hmm. So that tells you how 4 years or so that we did those missions. Now, that moonshot was not a landing. It was, you know, can we navigate a spacecraft to the moon?
Yeah.
Can we put the spacecraft in orbit? Can we get the spacecraft back out of orbit?
Yes.
And then can we get home safely? And, of course, it was an amazing success, and they took that famous picture of Earthrise.
Oh, yes.
You know, and yeah. of course Neil deGrasse Tyson loves to say, we went to the moon, but we discovered Earth. And that
yes.
picture was so
yes.
powerful culturally.
Yes.
Yeah. And fun fact also is that the commander of Apollo 8, first to go around the moon, was Frank Borman.
Mm-hmm.
Who owned Borman Autoplex.
Yes.
That's right.
Yes. Yes.
Here in Las Cruces.
A lot of
that's connections. Fun, too. Okay, so anyway, Artemis II is a repeat in a sense of Apollo 8. You know, it's been so long since we've sent spacecraft with humans out there. So this is an interesting flight. They're going to lift off, then they're going to go into a very elongated high orbit around the Earth to test all their systems. And then they can come home more safely that way if something's not working. And then they'll do what's called the translunar injection burn.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll go out to the moon, and they're just going to do a circle 8. They're not going to go into orbit like Apollo 8 does.
Okay.
They're going to just do a large loop. And they're going to go around the far side at such a high distance that they will be the farthest humans
yes.
from Earth ever.
Yeah.
And I like to add, this will be the first time we have a woman who's going out to the moon. We had 24 men in the Apollo program.
Yeah.
So that's very exciting.
Well, and a Canadian.
And
a Canadian.
Yeah. And I think three of them have all flown in space before, but one has not. So that will be exciting for them? I can't remember the names of the astronauts.
The bigger picture, the bigger plan is to eventually establish a moon base and use that in an eventual trip to Mars. How realistic is all of that, do you think?
I think all of it's doable. It's just a question of the political and national will or the human will. It's all doable.
How about actually the notion that you could actually live on Mars? Is that doable?
I think it's absolutely doable. It might be tough. I mean, we're talking about a situation where the atmosphere is too thin. You'd have to wear some kind of breathing assistance apparatus. And you might even need to wear some kind of light pressure suit just to be comfortable. But it's totally doable. And I think that humans have the ingenuity to figure out how to do this. You know, the interesting thing about living on Mars is if you have multi-generations, you might actually have over time speciation. I think that's what they call it.
Yes.
You know, which could happen. And they say that the on Mars, you know, I forget, there's a really amazing video I saw from PBS Spacetime about it and how slowly humans would change on Mars and it would become favored to be taller, for example, as the gravity is lower, things like this, you know. So that's kind of interesting. That could happen with time, but I think it's all doable.
Yeah.
And, you know, the thing that's interesting about with NASA now is for the last 50 plus years, there's just sort of been this mismatch between NASA dreams and administration, you know, and Congress. And it's just been sort of this hit and miss thing for the last 50 years. So it may be that we have this new Jared Isaacman as the administrator, and he seems to really be rolling up his sleeves. And he's realized that the initial Artemis plan, you know, Artemis 1, Artemis 2, and then Artemis 3 being the landing, that, no, that's we're skipping too many steps. And so he's put in an Artemis 3 as an intermediate mission and then Artemis 4. And so my point to the listeners is that it's a fluid program at this point in time. They're figuring that out. But I believe that Jared Isaacman is dedicated to making this happen. Right. So,
and those of us who grew up with 2001 A Space Odyssey are really excited about possibilities, too.
Absolutely. So I would say to all your listeners, sit down. Take some time. History is going to be made today, and it's at 4:30 p.m. Our time is the scheduled launch, 80% good weather chance. The launch window lasts till April 6th, but get on YouTube, go to NASA TV. There's going to be plenty of, you know, space.com. They'll be streaming it live. Just get on YouTube and watch this thing because it will be history in the making.
That is really thrilling.
Yeah,
and it's, you know, a little amazing how blasé we are. We've become towards this. You know, it's.
I think that the public has this feeling of NASA has cried wolf for 50 years.
Yeah.
I'm watching the news and mainstream news. They're not even talking about it.
Of course, right.
There's a lot of events going on in the world, and they're moving very quickly right now. But still.
But still.
This is going to the moon.
And I think that could reinvigorate, especially among younger viewers, that quest, that sense of adventure and intellectually curiosity. When I was, let's say, back in the early 70s, I did an internship, journalism internship with NASA. And the whole goal was, how can we convince people that it really benefits their daily lives, what they're discovering in terms of, you know, it's not just, you know, fun foods or things that you have in little food packs, but that there's some real benefits to living here on Earth. And I think the ultimate benefit is to see how fragile our planet is, like with the moon rise and how the Earth rise and how we are really all in this together.
Absolutely.
So it's an intellectual, moral dimension that we gain, as well as technical inventions that can assist.
Yeah. I mean, there's the practical economics as well. I mean, every dollar spent on space is spent on the planet Earth, and people have jobs and doing
this. Yes, that's right.
But, you know, I want to speak very quickly to your idea of that sort of broader unity of humanity and Earth. There is a gentleman by the name of Frank White who has coined a term called the overview effect. And you can, again, you could go to YouTube, and there is a video called The Overview Effect. It's about 20 minutes long, and it will put you in a dream state of euphoria of what it is to be a citizen of the galaxy, a citizen of your planet, a citizen of the cosmic ecosystem, just by going out into space and seeing the Earth as it truly is, a little blue fragile ball in space. And to understand really what that means. And so you have a true cognitive shift. And what Frank White says is your identity fundamentally changes. And once that happens, the whole world the way it is, and hopefully we could move on from it.
Well, once again, we have been talking. And what, I wish we were done there. What a great way to end it. We do have a couple more minutes. We're talking with Chris Churchill. He is going to be one of the presenters this month for the Academy for Learning and Retirement. Go over those again real quickly. The dates are going to be Tuesday, April 7th, Thursday, April 9th. Chris's presentation will be Tuesday, April 14th. And the final one will be Thursday, April 16th. I know that I'm asking you a final question that there won't be enough time to answer, so I apologize ahead of time. But I'm curious what your thoughts are about SpaceX and Virgin Galactic and the attempt to privatize this and how that has worked so far.
Well, that's also another very large, interesting topic. In short, I think that there's this strange dichotomy between space companies that are pushing the envelope and then how fast they're able to push the envelope because they get ahead of regulation, they get ahead of space laws and things like that. Mm-hmm. And so you have people like creating a world that we don't yet know the implications of all that. But as far as space tourism goes, I believe that Jeff Bezos would say that space tourism is a revenue generating mechanism for his larger dreams. Right. And he will tell you that he does care about the planet Earth, that he wants to get humans to be spacefaring and build something called O'Neill colonies so that Earth can be preserved and people can live in these colonies. And of course, anybody who goes up in space experiences the overview effect and brings that home. That's a good thing, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then so SpaceX, I mean, what Elon Musk has done for rocketry and access to space is tremendous, but some of the things that he's pushing forward faster than people can, you know, understand what that means, I have a lot of problems with that. So the Starlink satellites, for example, are a problem for astronomers because you know, you see them streaking across your telescope images.
Of course, yeah, I haven't thought about that.
Yeah, so I could talk for another half hour. So I better just stop there. But you know, it's a mixed bag. But that's the way humans have always continued to push frontiers. Yeah. Is that there are certain people who are pushing them, they're pushing them faster than laws and regulations and things can understand what they're gonna, how that's gonna have an outcome. Yeah. And that's just, that'll be happening in space.
Well, this has been a fascinating discussion, and I really encourage anyone who is interested in space to attend these this program at the Academy for Learning and Retirement. Anything else that you would like to share with us just at the very, very end?
Oh, I'd just like to say that I think all the talks will probably be very fascinating. You know, Jason, everybody in this group are world experts at what they do, and they're all excellent speakers. I can vouch for that, and they're very passionate about what they do. So I think it will be a wonderful experience. You'll learn a lot of new things about what's happening and have an opportunity to ask some great questions, too.